A new border reality today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. U.S. troops are putting up razor wire in Nogales, Arizona, a border town with Mexico where some businesses worry their customers are being scared off.
Do you want to shop at a place where you're not welcome?
One of those Mexican customers is also worried.
Pues que no está bien. Todos somos hermanos, que no.
I don't think what they're doing is good, she says. We're all brothers and sisters.
All while the Trump administration wants to restrict where along the border migrants can ask for asylum.
The message that this is sending to the world is that it's okay to shut out refugees and asylum seekers, that it's okay to have people be in dangerous circumstances without any recourse.
Changes along the U.S.-Mexico border today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is Friday. Thanks for making it today. Matthew Whitaker was not a household name before this week. Now he's the new acting attorney general, thrust into a hot spotlight, followed quickly by big questions about how he's going to handle business at the Department of Justice, especially when it comes to the Russia investigation. Meanwhile, Whitaker has been busy signing off on a new policy for asylum in this country. The changes would limit where along the U.S.-Mexico border asylum seekers can submit their claims. It is a controversial move by Trump. But speaking outside the White House today before boarding the presidential helicopter, the president said his new asylum policy was necessary.
It's very important. We need Democrat support or new immigration laws to bring us up to date. The laws are obsolete and they're incompetent. They are the worst laws any country has anywhere in the world.
Serene Shabaya is with us to explain. She's a civil rights lawyer based in Washington. Serene, lay it out for us, if you would. What are the new rules in this proclamation on asylum?
Well, basically, the new rules deny the opportunity to apply for asylum to anybody who does not come in at a port of entry, so at one of the official border stations where there's inspection and et cetera. And that new rule is really, it kind of flies in the face of the asylum laws themselves, which very clearly set out that anybody who's already in the United States or who arrives in the United States, regardless of where they arrive or their immigration status, has the opportunity to apply for asylum.
So it sounds like you're saying per domestic laws, these rules are not legal.
Exactly. Per domestic laws, but also per our international obligations. I mean, the U.S. is a signatory to the 1967 protocol, which defines a refugee and places certain obligations on the United States to provide protection to those who qualify as refugees. And in 1980, Congress incorporated this definition into the U.S. immigration laws in the Refugee Act of 1980. And that's where our asylum laws come from. And the language is right in there in the asylum statute. Whether or not at a designated port of arrival, and including someone who's brought after being interdicted in international waters, and irrespective of immigration status, that everybody who comes here who meets the definition of a refugee has the chance to apply for asylum.
Now, I know you'd been part of a lawsuit, Serene, that challenged President Trump's travel ban for people coming to the U.S. from majority Muslim countries. Do you think this proclamation is also going to face court challenges like the travel ban did?
I do. I think that it will undoubtedly face court challenges. And I also worked on a lawsuit challenging family separation at the border. And in my mind, all of those things are of a piece. This administration is trying to use every means possible to stop people from accessing their rights in the United States, whether they come at the border or whether they are in countries abroad.
What part of the asylum rules will be challenged first, do you think?
It's hard to say in advance. I think there's a lot of different legal challenges that are being worked up at the moment. But I think the fact that this conflicts so clearly with the language of the asylum provisions in the immigration laws, and the fact that there's really no emergency or other situation that could possibly justify that suspension, will be really sort of strong points for the legal challenges that are undoubtedly going to be filed soon. And I think if I may, I'd like to say something about this port of entry issue. I mean, the Trump administration has been saying for some months now that people should come at ports of entry, and that's the regular way to present yourself and seek asylum. But the reality that we saw over the summer, for example, is that when people did come to ports of entry, they were made to wait for days and days. And Customs and Border Protection officials were telling them the bridge is closed, you can't come in, we have no space for you. And then the flip side of that, too, is to recognize the factual circumstances that people are in. I mean, I've spoken to parents who walked for a month or two to get to the United States border. And those parents frequently don't understand where a port of entry is. And if they come in at certain points at the border, they would have to walk, for example, an additional 1,000 miles in some cases to get to a port of entry after a harrowing journey where they're fleeing violence and persecution, where they come to the border, to any point on the border, trying to look for immigration officials to turn themselves into so that they can apply for the protection of asylum.
How has the international community reacted to this change to U.S. asylum rules?
I would imagine that the international community is going to react in the same way that it reacted when Trump issued his Muslim ban, and in the same way that it reacted when Trump started separating families at the border intentionally. I think that the international community is going to be very disturbed. And on the other hand, I also think that this is really problematic because the U.S. has historically been a country that accepts asylum seekers and accepts refugees and has been sort of a leader in giving an example to the rest of the world that we should be welcoming and open. And unfortunately, the message that this is sending to the world is that it's okay to shut out refugees and asylum seekers. It's okay to flout our international obligations, and it's okay to have people be in dangerous circumstances without any recourse.
Sareen Shabaya, civil rights lawyer with the Muslim Advocates in Washington. Thanks for speaking with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
By the way, after we spoke with Sareen Shabaya, civil rights groups filed a lawsuit in California to block the Trump administration's new restrictions on asylum. We'll be following that story in the coming days. Right now, more than 5,000 active duty U.S. troops are deployed near the Mexican border. President Trump gave the order to send them there just ahead of the midterm elections. The reason? Those so-called migrant caravans. Large groups of migrants are heading north through Mexico, but to be clear, they're still hundreds of miles away from U.S. soil. Reporter Jude Joffe Block went to Nogales in Arizona, right on the Mexican border. She asked people there what they think about the U.S. troops who just arrived.
The first sighting of the troops in Nogales came this week. They appeared right in the heart of downtown, across the street from a bridal store, next to the border fence. I see about a dozen Army soldiers in camouflage. Soldiers wearing helmets install loops of silver concertina razor wire on top of the fence. I watch with Bruce Bracker. He's a county supervisor here. He says many locals are upset about this.
We're not happy because we have barbed wire going up on top of our fence in the middle of our community. This is out of line.
There's Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Mexico, across the border. A lot of people here consider both towns one binational community. Bracker says razor wire isn't needed here. In fact, the community has fought it before. He worries it sends the wrong message to Mexican shoppers who come to Nogales, Arizona to buy shoes, clothes, and electronics.
Do you want to shop in a place where you're not welcome?
Bracker says sending troops here is political theater, an overreaction to a group of Central Americans migrating through Mexico.
They're going to have the military stationed on the border for 2 months before anybody even gets here from this migrant caravan that is being called the, quote, the invasion.
The troops' role here is pretty limited. They can't detain or arrest migrants. The military says they'll support border agencies with transportation, engineering, medical support, and logistics.
From my understanding, they can't do much. They're not allowed to really do much but be a force, just a presence.
That's Joshua Rubin. He crosses this border every day from Arizona to Mexico to help manage manufacturing facilities there. He's served in the military before and joins us on the sidewalk watching the soldiers. He doesn't mind the troops are here.
I think something useful can come out of it. It's just showing the force saying that the country's kind of fed up with the lax immigration policy that we have.
But to many people on the other side of this fence, U.S. immigration policies seem anything but lax. On the Mexican side, about a five-minute walk from where the soldiers are putting up the razor wire, a small group of Mexican and Central American families are camped with blankets and sleeping mats. There are kids as young as two. These families are not part of the so-called caravan, though they've all heard about it. They're trying to seek asylum in the U.S., but until U.S. officials call out their numbers, they must wait for days in Mexico. There have been lines like this for months. It's frustrating, says Antonio. He's a Nicaraguan asylum seeker. He's been waiting 9 days with his wife after a grueling journey to get here. He doesn't give his full name because he says he's fleeing death threats for protesting the Nicaraguan government. Hundreds have already died in the government's violent crackdown on protesters there. Antonio, like others here, heard the Trump administration is sending troops to the border,
but didn't know soldiers were already so close by.
A nosotros no nos dan ni miedo. O sea, no hay intimidación para nosotros.
Antonio says the troops don't scare or intimidate him, since he and his wife are following the law by asking for asylum. I then join the long line back into the U.S. and meet Maria Felix Vargas, who lives in Mexico and works at a flower shop.
Pues voy a comprar un regalito para mi hijo porque viene su cumpleaños.
She's crossing into Arizona to buy her son a birthday gift. She hasn't heard about the soldiers arriving, so I show her photos I took earlier on my phone.
Ese alambre.
Uh-huh. Oh. Es nuevo.
She notices the new razor wire that's up.
Ay, pues.
She looks worried.
Pues que no está bien. No está bien lo que van a hacer, digo, porque pues todos somos hermanos, ¿qué no? Se supone. Y que tenemos que amar al prójimo.
I don't think what they're doing is good, she says. We're all brothers and sisters. We have to love our neighbors, like God says. As we inch closer to the U.S. border, Vargas tells me she doesn't cross into Arizona as often as she used to. This line is too long. And now she has new concerns that the military on the border will spark violence here. For the world, Jude Joffe Block, Nogales, Arizona.
A lot of these issues get echoed in border music. Just make the 13.5-hour drive from Nogales to Austin, Texas. You'll find the band Superfónicos. They're just out with a new EP.
This is Nico Sanchez. I play bass in Superfónicos.
I'm Jaime Ospina. I'm lead singer for Superfónicos.
So the EP is titled Suelta. The idea behind it is kind of to let go of the things in life that are holding us back on a societal level. Racism, misogyny, homophobia, xenophobia. Ultimately, we want to just let people know that we're all ultimately the same. And we're not as divided as some people in power might want to make it seem.
This is a moment in human history where politicians are being very successful in like creating walls. And you can go and fight them and lose the battle and be exhausted in the end, or you can just like show your back to them and start building bridges.
Jaime Ospina and Nico Sanchez of Superfónicos. Suelta is their latest release. We'll let the tune El Miedo take us to the break. What's the biggest sports rivalry in the world? If you're from Buenos Aires, there's only one good answer to that question. River Boca. Or Boca River. I don't want to play favorites here. That story next, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Okay, what's the biggest rivalry in sports? Around here, it's Red Sox-Yankees. But what about Duke-UNC? Army-Navy? Real Madrid, Barcelona? None of those makes a blip on the scale of epic rivalries to soccer fans in Argentina. There, it's Boca Juniors versus River Plate. The rivalry even has a name, the Argentine Super Clásico. This weekend, River Plate and Boca Juniors will play for the Copa Libertadores. It's the Super Bowl of South American soccer. Juan Arango is a soccer commentator. He says that Boca-River is the mother of all rivalries.
Let me put it more as a recipe for a great meal. Yankees, Red Sox, UNC, Duke, Packers, Bears, Lazio, Rome. Add all that into a pot, and you probably are going to get a little bit of a taste of what Boca Juniors is. I remember talking to my father-in-law once. He says, Real Madrid, Barcelona, yeah, that's El Clásico, but that's not a Clásico. We have a Super Clásico, which is... It really entails a lot of not just what occurs on the pitch, but what occurs outside of it, and even to a social, political, and socioeconomic strata as well.
Wow, sounds really intense. For these two teams to be in the final, that hasn't happened in a long time, right?
That's never happened.
Never.
Within the 58 years that this tournament has been played, never have we seen a final between two teams from the same city.
Zoom us into Buenos Aires and tell us what this rivalry between Boca Juniors and River Plate is all about. How far back does it go?
It pretty much goes back to the beginning of the 20th century when both clubs happened to be in the same neighborhood fighting for a spot. Okay, who is the big team in the neighborhood? And eventually they played a loser leaves town type of match. And of course, Boca won that match. Boca stayed in that neighborhood of La Boca. River Plate moves about 10, 15 miles away. So you have a bit of a buffer separating these two teams.
The flag, the yellow and blue, there's a Swedish connection there. What's that about?
Well, if you look at, again, the geography of La Boca, the neighborhood where Boca Juniors is, it's pretty much a port area where lots of boats come in from the Atlantic Ocean. The originators or the founders of the club weren't being able to come into agreement into what the team colors were. They said, okay, fine, let's find a compromise. Let's go out to the edge of La Boca and just sit there and wait. The first boat that comes in, based on the colors of the flag, that'll be the club's colors. And that boat happened to be the one that came from Sweden. And to this day, that's been the color scheme.
Now, one thing that really distinguishes Boca Juniors is their home stadium. It's a place known as La Bombonera, or the Chocolate Box. Where did that name come from?
It's just the shape of the stadium. Many will tell you when you're walking around in that stadium doesn't shake. It beats. It has its own heartbeat. Fans jumping in unison, singing from the time that they get into the stadium to the time that they leave. I've had the pleasure of being there for Copa Libertadores final, and you have this exhilarating feeling. You're about to see something that you've never been able to see in your life, and at the same time you say, I might not come out of this alive. You have that sensation of those two feelings kind of colliding, and it's contagious within the fans.
It sounds like it can get pretty darn intense. I gather with some of the bad blood between these two teams and their fans, there's a rule that visiting fans are not allowed at these matches. What's that about? Like, they can't cross the other side of the city and go to follow their team?
I always use Chris Rock as a comparison.
I love Chris Rock. I'm waiting to hear this.
He says, at one time, he says, hey, you can drive with your knees, but it's not a good idea. As far as that's concerned. I can be a River fan in this case and go to La Boca, but is that advisable? As soon as the final was made official, you started to see fans go after each other in the street. You know, you've had already one person killed because of this rivalry in Argentina, unfortunately. As far as the no visitors in stadiums, that's been a law that's been implemented by the Argentine government, not just for this match. This has been implemented for over a decade, where you do not allow visiting fans to come in to matches because that really is a risk of possible danger.
Yeah, well, not only does it get intense, it gets hazardous too. Juan, settle this argument once and for all. Is this the biggest, most intense sports rivalry in the world?
I've lived through it, and I've seen exactly how the nation goes topsy-turvy over this. I think we still romanticize about it, but in terms of intensity, I don't know of a rivalry that's bigger than that.
Juan, we're going to leave it there. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
And now a few words from Groucho Marx.
Now here is a little peninsula, and here is a viaduct leading over to the mainland.
Viaduct.
I'm all right. How are you? I say here is a little peninsula, and here is a viaduct leading over to the mainland.
All right. Viaduct.
I'm not playing ask me another. I say that's a viaduct.
All right. Viaduct. It's what I... Viaduct. Why are no chickens?
I'll tell you, viaduct. Vi a mandarin duck. Native to China and Japan, one of them somehow found his way to the pond in New York Central Park in all his glorious cuteness. The past few days have turned this little guy into a social media sensation. New Yorkers are literally lining up to get a look at the duck. I asked Mark Faraday of the Mass Audubon Society how the duck got there.
It's pretty clearly a bird that escaped from someone's collection. Mandarin duck is a species that you can purchase online for $125 for a pair. And because they're so beautiful, they're often kept in private collections. And so when you see a bird like this, and it's got a band on its leg, so that further cements the fact that it's of captive origin, you know that it was released by somebody or escaped. It's not a bird that has a tendency to migrate long distances and turn up places they're not supposed to.
Describe for us what a perfect Mandarin duck looks like.
So the males are the really spectacular ones, and it's got all kinds of colors and specialized feathers on the head. It has kind of a crest that droops down behind the head. They're closely related to, I think, maybe not equally beautiful, but pretty close, a duck that's pretty common here in the eastern U.S., the wood duck. But the Mandarin duck is like a step above. It's like a fever dream of a bird with this incredible collection of intense colors.
Do you have a kind of in your mind a narrative of how this duck ended up in the park? Like somebody left their window open and the duck – I mean, how did that happen?
The duck had a bad attitude, so whoever owned it kicked it out of the car. You know, it's anyone's guess. You could capture it and get some information off the band and figure out who owned it, then we could solve that mystery. But it probably comes down to somebody's private waterfowl collection, and there are a lot of those. But the fact that it ended up in Central Park, somebody probably put it there. They didn't want it anymore, like, oh, this is a good place for a duck.
That's kind of sad. I mean, can this duck just spend the rest of its life in Manhattan?
If it can afford the rent. so people, you know, might feed it. It could probably survive the winter there. But it's really kind of a dead-end situation. You know, it can't breed. There aren't other Mandarin ducks. It's not going to migrate back to China or Europe in the spring. So you wonder about the future for this bird.
I mean, you said there is a band on this bird's foot. So a strong suggestion that it did come from somebody's collection, of perhaps somebody in an apartment in Manhattan. This is a waterfowl. I mean, I just have a really hard time imagining a duck, yeah, even a small duck, in somebody's apartment.
Right.
In the keeping bathtub in the whole time?
Keeping it in the bathtub in their studio. Probably not. They don't do well in walk-ups. I'm sure it was somebody in the suburbs.
Short legs.
Yeah, right.
What do you think is the best outcome for this Mandarin duck?
Probably placed in a private collection where it will be well cared for.
Mark Faraday with the Mass Audubon Society, thanks for being with us today.
No problem.
I'm Marco Werman. Canada apologized this week for something it did in the 1930s, refusing to take in Jewish refugees fleeing Germany. The son of one of those refugees describes his mother's reaction.
For my mother, it was very important. Very important because it was personal.
One country that did welcome Jewish refugees, the Dominican Republic. Those stories still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston.
Wir müssen zwei bohrende Fragen beantworten. Erstens,
German Chancellor Angela Merkel speaking today at a synagogue in Berlin. It was a ceremony to mark a notorious day in German history. November 9th, 1938 was when Kristallnacht began. It was a two-day surge of violence against Jews. Nazis tore through German streets, shattering windows in thousands of synagogues and Jewish-owned stores. Kristallnacht is widely seen as an opening to the Holocaust. Our next story is about something that took place a few months before Kristallnacht, in July 1938, a diplomatic gathering in France. Representatives of 32 nations, including the U.S., assembled in the town of Avignon to discuss what to do about German-Jewish refugees. Only one of the countries there made a commitment to take them in, the Dominican Republic. The World's Jason Margolis met a man in New Hampshire who's made it his mission to bring that story to light.
This is a story that begins with a baseball souvenir. Hugh Baver is a former minor league player, and now in his late 50s, he still looks in good enough shape to still play. His New Hampshire office is littered with baseball photos, signed gloves, and knickknacks.
I tend to collect just individual, unique items that are a little different.
including a base from the final game of the 2013 World Baseball Classic. The Dominican Republic won that year. Baver decides to donate the base to the country. He flies to Santo Domingo and meets with the famous Dominican player, Jesus Alou.
Well, you know, we were just doing our usual talking about baseball and all that, and he happened to mention, you know, you might be interested to know that there's this Jewish community that's up on the north coast of the island, which originated from some conference or something like that. So it was very vague, but it was enough that it stayed, you know, in my mind, very, very much stuck in my mind.
So Baver, who's Jewish, starts doing some research. He learns about the Evian Conference convened in France by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in July of 1938, and how only the Dominican Republic agreed to take in German Jewish refugees. The Dominican dictator Rafael Trujillo offered them safety for a promise to develop the jungle, hard work on poor soil. Historians also say Trujillo wanted to whiten up his country.
They agreed to take up to 100,000 Jews and do that on very liberal terms, giving them 26,000 acres, a mule, a cow. You know, to me, it was kind of like Gilligan's Island was my favorite show growing up. So to me, it's kind of like dropping in these people who don't know how to farm onto an island.
In the end, only about 700 German Jews made it there.
The Dominican Republic, about the size of Holland and Belgium, with a population of about 1.5 million, has opened its heart to the homeless people of a troubled Europe. Number one settlement is at Sosua Bay.
René Kirchheimer's father was among the refugees who were sent to the outpost Sosua. He worked in the fashion industry in Germany, escaped to Luxembourg, then the Dominican Republic, where he found a much different life awaiting him.
My father, when he had a farm, he raised cows and he raised pigs as well. And he won a lot of prizes in the country fairs.
I see.
I always said as a joke that we're very kosher pigs.
Kirchheimer's mother also came from Germany, but wasn't Jewish. Kirchheimer was born in the Dominican Republic in 1942. I spoke with him via phone from Sosua.
I'm home right now, looking out the window.
Okay.
But I got my head out the window.
Why do you have your head out the window?
To get the Wi-Fi signal is a little better. I don't want you to fade away.
We get the connection working, and Kirchheimer tells me it wasn't so easy in Sosua in the 1940s.
It was very, very, very pioneer. When you see the old Westerns, the movies, it's very similar. At the first few years, we didn't even have electricity. You know, that came later. And we had like these kerosene lamps. And we had a big vessel to have cool water.
A tough life, but Kirchheimer has fond memories. He says he had black and brown friends, and nobody cared that he was a Jew. Today, he says only a handful of the descendants of Jewish refugees are left in Sosua. Most eventually left for the United States. The agricultural experiment in Sosua long ago transformed into a beach resort town. The small synagogue still stands there. They don't have a rabbi, but Kirchheimer says for the holidays, they improvise.
So the older gentleman, he knows the routine, you know, he knows how to hold a ceremony. So he's not a certified rabbi, but he'll do.
I asked Kirchheimer what he'd like people to know about the story of his town.
I would like the Dominican Republic get the proper recognition for the gesture they had back in the Evian Conference in 1938. If everybody had done the same, a lot of Jews would have been saved.
And that takes us back to New Hampshire and Hugh Baver. After he met Kirchheimer and the other remaining Jewish descendants in Sosua, he became determined to spread their story. 3 years ago, Baver made his way to France and the five-star resort on Lake Geneva, where the nine-day conference was held back in 1938.
I wasn't wearing my nicest clothes. I had on my Michigan State baseball hat, and I was just kind of a tourist, you know. And they were giving me a hard time even letting me in. And so finally I lied and said, I'm a journalist from Boston here to report on a story.
He talks his way into getting the manager at the Hotel Royal to show him around.
There wasn't one person in the entire hotel who had any idea that the conference even ever took place there. They had nothing. They had nothing in any of their information. They had nothing that was up. The hotel staff had no idea of it.
Baver was astonished. This was the spot where 31 nations turned their backs on Jewish refugees.
Very shortly after that conference ended, Hitler got up on a stage and said, well, obviously, if no one cares about the Jews, why should I? you know, it's known as Hitler's green light to genocide and the most fateful, you know, conference of all times for the Jews. But yet, nobody knows this. Not nobody. Very, very, very few people knew it.
Soon, many more will. He set up a nonprofit called Sesua 75, regularly gives lectures, and then there's this.
I just received this today. This is the cast bronze plaque, which I had commissioned to be done, and the hotel agreed to have this be affixed on the wall in the same room where the conference took place. So I have to apologize if I get a little emotional, but it's been a long road to get to this.
Baver is presenting that plaque in France today. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Those 31 countries that said no to taking in Jewish refugees in 1938, the United States was one of them. So was Canada.
When Canadian lawmakers returned from Evian, they used their power to further tighten the rules around Jewish immigration, legitimizing the anti-Semitic sentiment taking hold at home and abroad.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau there speaking in Parliament in Ottawa this week.
Today I rise in this House of Commons to issue a long overdue apology to the Jewish refugees Canada turned away.
That was in 1939. Canada turned away a ship carrying more than 900 Jews fleeing the Nazis.
We used our laws to mask our anti-Semitism, our antipathy, our resentment. We are sorry for the callousness of Canada's response, and we are sorry for not apologizing sooner.
Danny Gruner was there to hear the apology in person, along with his mother, Anna Maria Gordon. She was among the hundreds of people aboard the MS St. Louis that Canada turned away. Danny, thanks for being here. What was Wednesday like for you and your mother? What do you make of the apology that day?
Wednesday was a momentous day for us. It was especially so for my mother. My mother has been asked repeatedly if this was what she had expected. And my mom says, I never expected anybody to apologize, and certainly not in this way. Mm. It was just beyond anything we had expected.
Yeah, tell me about your meeting. You and your mother both met with Prime Minister Trudeau privately. What was that like? Tell us what was said.
So we went in. It was my mother and I and my youngest son, who's 27 now. And Trudeau received us in his office very warmly. But I could sense that for the prime minister, it was like realizing that it was the moment of truth, that he was now finally face to face with a person he was going to personally apologize to. Somebody who had endured this, and he really expected or needed this for in some way for reassurance. So it was a very warm conversation in private. What can I say? I mean, it's not something you do every day, right? For my mother, it was very important because it was personal.
Considering your mother wasn't expecting an apology, what were her emotions during this meeting?
She was floored, basically, just by the fact that we were there with the highest officer of the land and receiving this personal attention and personal apology, because it's more than just standing in a house and issuing an apology for a greater community or for a bunch of people who don't live anymore. It's very different. This one was personal.
So, Danny, tell me more about your mother's story. She was among the 900-plus people on the MS St. Louis. How old was she at the time?
She was 4 years old when she was on the ship, but she was there with my grandparents as well as my great-uncle and his wife. And, of course, they had to endure the horrors of the war. They went back to you. They were shipped back to Europe. They ended up in concentration camps. And by whatever miracle, they survived.
So everybody reunites, and it's a long and winding road. But eventually, your mom ends up in Canada. And if I get this correctly, your mother is the only surviving member of the MS St. Louis who lives in Canada today. How does it feel for her and for you to live in the country today that rejected her and her family some 80 years ago?
Well, I've been living here for nearly 40 years. Canada has changed a whole lot. Even in the time that we're here, we live in Toronto, it's really a mosaic that contains every possible nationality, color, creed, everybody in the world. And everybody, by and large, lives in harmony. It's a fantastic place.
Yeah, but Trudeau's apology this week, I mean, he admitted that Canada's problems with anti-Semitism and xenophobia are not a thing of the past. So I'm just wondering how you experience that reality in Canada today.
He's absolutely right. There's been a resurgence of hate, a resurgence of anti-Semitism, among others. But it's not just a local phenomenon, and it's not really being felt as much in Canada as in other places. But just listen to the rhetoric around the world. And this is the full spectrum of politics around the world. It's totalitarian. It's populist. It is hate-mongering. There is a lot of that going on today, whether it's in Europe, whether it's here with our neighbors to the south, whether it's in South America, anywhere else in the world.
Well, you reference your neighbors to the south. That would be the United States. And one of the big stories here in the U.S. today is the Trump administration moving to limit the rights of asylum seekers. I don't know if you've been following that story, but
absolutely.
Are you making connections between your family story, your mother's story, and recent events here in the U.S. and in your country?
Yes, absolutely. The most horrible thought that comes into everybody's mind is that history is being repeated. That the lessons of history from 80 years ago have not been heeded. And part of my speech that I gave in the evening reception on Wednesday, I made allusion to the fact that we were on the eve of the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day. And today is the 80th anniversary of Kristallnacht, right? That's the big pogrom that started the Holocaust, basically. And then we're seeing blatantly anti-Semitic incidents like the shooting in Pittsburgh. It's unbelievable that this can happen. Rhetoric that vilifies the other. It is as if it's giving license to hate, that it's okay to spew hate and it's okay to speak evil of others and then do these things.
You know, some people say, yes, this is true. This is how fascism began in the 1930s. But there are not millions of dead all around us. How do you respond to that?
I would say there are not yet necessarily millions of dead. That's the scary part. It is how it started. In the 1930s, there weren't millions of dead around you. Right?
Danny Gruner speaking with us from Toronto. His mother, Anna Maria Gordon, was a Jewish refugee on the MS St. Louis. This week, Canada's prime minister apologized for turning her and more than 900 other Jewish refugees on the ship back in 1939. Danny, thank you very much for telling us your story and for being with us today.
Well, it's important. It's a very important story to tell. And in the words of my mother, one should never forget history and repeat past mistakes.
Lush jungle, spider monkeys jumping from tree to tree, lots of birds and frogs. Picture, if you will, Puerto Rico's El Junque National Forest. It's the Amazon rainforest of the island. But El Junque is more than just a natural haven. It's vital for the people who live around it. Hurricane Maria hit the forest hard last year. And as the world's Carolyn Beeler reports, people in the area are concerned about its future.
This is a research trail.
Grisel Gonzalez has worked in El Junque National Forest for 26 years. She runs a long-term research project here. And when she visited just a few days after Hurricane Maria's 130-mile-an-hour winds hit...
It was shocking. It was really shocking. It was all brown. There was no leaves. All you could see were like toothpicks, standing or on the ground. It's like a bomb hit.
And it was silent. No leaves to rustle in the wind or birds to sing.
It was scary. You get very depressed. It's like, oh, there's so much death.
But just a few days later, tiny buds and fragile green shoots had already started to sprout.
It's almost like nature shows you the way of recovery and that, okay, if nature is recovering, you can recover too and you know, getting gear.
El Junque has been shaped by hurricanes for thousands of years, and research by Gonzalez's team shows they can actually be good for the forest in some ways. Leaves and branches that get knocked to the ground fertilize the soil and sort of supercharge new plant growth.
This road looks much different than
I can see that as I walk along a path in the forest with Gonzalez. The forest is lush and green again, and birds are chirping over our heads. But by about a year after the storm, the landscape still looks totally different to Gonzalez.
So before, if you could picture it, there was complete canopy cover here. It would be completely lush and still very dark. And look what we see now.
What we see now is a lot of blue sky. Maria killed more than 1 in 10 trees here. Many others lost most of their branches. We're looking at a couple palms that have just a few fronds sticking straight up out of the top, like Dr. Seuss drew them. As we walk, Gonzalez expertly navigates thick tangles of ferns and grasses that didn't used to be here. She tells me, with many tall trees gone, the light reaches plants on the ground now.
And that's how we see that some species, called the pioneer species, start growing. So what we see here is a natural process of regeneration.
This process is as old as the forest itself. But Gonzalez is worried about the future. Climate change is expected to make big storms more powerful.
If these forests get these hurricanes at a pace that is 50, 60 years, it'll probably be enough time for them to recover. But if the hurricanes keep coming at a shorter interval, then the forest might not have the time to recover.
Gonzalez says eventually this forest could change completely. And that's a problem, not just for the ecosystem. It would also be a problem for the people who rely on the water that runs through the forest for swimming and cooling off, and for drinking.
It's a huge source of water for much of the island, actually.
Jessica Chappell is a PhD candidate at the University of Georgia who's studying the hydrology of El Junque.
20% of the population relies on water that comes from El Junque. And so what that actually means is that 20% of the water that's used falls within the forest, and then it goes into streams and taken to the people.
The forest acts kind of like a reservoir, holding rainwater and slowly releasing it. If that starts to change, surrounding communities could someday start running out of water from the forest. But right now, today, they're facing a different problem. Heavy rains like those that came with Maria are overwhelming the forest's natural ability to filter the water they drink. There's an example of that in the tiny village of Barcelona, which is just a few hundred feet below the main entrance to El Junque. Water coming out of the faucets here flows directly from a small reservoir in the forest. It's not treated or filtered at all.
Viene del río del Junque.
Standing in her kitchen, Lisa Perez Sanjarjo tells me that after Hurricane Maria, that reservoir in the forest, it was clogged with fallen trees, so there was no water coming out of the taps for 6 days. She tells me the community was stuck, so they cleared the reservoir and fixed broken pipes. But when the water finally did start flowing again, it was brown for 2 or 3 days. Plants and soil in the forest weren't filtering it like they usually do. She tells me the water was like chocolate.
Cuando va un golpe de agua, es chocolate. Chocolate, agua con tierra.
After the storm, Sanjarjo formed a committee to address some of Barcelona's water issues. Some of its members are hanging out on her front lawn before a meeting. They have handed out water filters and are thinking about ways to keep the water supply clean after big downpours. Sanjarjo says she recognizes that global warming may make their water quality issues worse, so they have to take charge. Water filters or a new reservoir system will help in the short term, but Grisel Gonzalez says how the forest might react to climate change over time is an open question.
As these events become stronger or more frequent, I think it's important that we are in the forest describing the condition and how it's recovering, because we don't know what's going to happen in the long term.
El Junque is one of the most studied tropical forests in the world. So what Gonzalez and her colleagues learn here could illuminate how tropical forests around the world will fare in the future. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, El Junque National Forest, Puerto Rico.
Wishing El Junque all the best in its recovery. Every little bit of help counts, even a sacred rhythm. The bell, the underpinning of many rhythms in West Africa. We're digging here into the back catalog of New York-born Puerto Rican trombonist Willie Colon. This is one of his classics. It's actually called Ganae, as in Ghana, in West Africa. And one more note before we go today. Remember yesterday when we asked you to send in photos of your rescue greyhounds? My friends, you not only obliged, you totally rocked our world. Now we want to share all the dog snaps you sent us. They're on our Facebook page and on Instagram at PRI The World. And I might not have a greyhound, but just for good measure, I did a selfie with me and my rescue, Frankie. That's also on our Facebook page. All right, everyone, time is up here. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.